Is the applause sign not working again?
And not only that, but the laugh track's on the fritz, too. It happens, especially on a Friday. Welcome aboard the Amy Berkley Show, weaving together a mosaic of voices from the arts, pop culture, personal growth, and justice. You were hanging in the justice realm yesterday, weren't we? A little more of that today, too. Thank you so much for joining us as we will talk about the sentencing of the reality show couple Teresa and Joe Giudice. Tweets have already been flying in throughout the day and in the mailbag. Also, Jodi Arias' eyeglasses were auctioned off, and there's controversy surrounding it. Who knew? We'll talk in the Free Flow Pop Culture Convo. Take a little musical romp through the autumn leaves and get you in the mix should you be listening live. Yeah, happy October 3rd. Thank you very much. 9 a.m. out west, 11 central, noon here in the east. Number in motion, 347-857-4505. Twitter feed, as we said, already getting busy at AB Writes. The show today brought to you in part by Sherwin-Williams. Sprucing up for fall, are you? Well, you can save on paints, stains, and other supplies at your local Sherwin-Williams store. And by the new improved PopNet, it's arts, culture, conversation, 24/7, on-air, online, the new improved PopNet. Today I want to, you know, reel us back into the importance of our show, which is about storytelling and how it empowers people and enlightens and transforms lives. And our guest today really has taken on this very fascinating project. Richard Engling is a noted theater professional, the co-founder and artistic director of the Polarity Ensemble Theater in Chicago, also the author of the forthcoming, it comes out officially next week, novel Anna in Darkness. He also put together this fascinating project called the Afterlife Trilogy. His novel, along with his late friend, the author Fern Chertko's novel, She Plays in Darkness, and a play called Anna in the Afterlife, which will get its world premiere at the Polarity Theater next spring, April of 2015. Delighted to welcome Richard to the show. I know you're busy getting all these projects in motion, but thank you so much for joining us today, Richard.
Delighted to be here.
What a fascinating idea. Talk to us about what started this concept for you. Was it Fern's novel that was ibbling at you all these years, and you decided to write sort of a companion novel, and then it took off from there? Or how did it start for you?
Actually, it started with the novel Visions of Anna. Fern was a very dear friend of mine. And as a tribute to her and a memorial of her and our friendship, I wrote the novel Visions of Anna. And when I was done, it wasn't long after that, another approach to the same topic, but an entirely new story as a play occurred to me, and I wrote the play Anna in the Afterlife. And as I was going through that, I was looking back at some of her papers and things, and it occurred to me that it would be a really interesting thing to sort of bundle the novel and the play and a work of Fern's.
Yes.
So I had a couple of her novels in manuscript that her parents had allowed me to take when she had died. When I looked at She Plays in Darkness, there were some really interesting parallels to what I had done. And the idea of reading the two novels and then seeing the play clicked into place as something that would be a really interesting journey for the readers and audience.
Yeah, and using the two media too. I mean, the idea of, and I'm also a novelist and a playwright, so I'm fascinated by that whole idea of different points of view and different media for different stories. And this way, you're putting these stories out there. In some ways, there's a thread, I guess. There's not the same story. We should say that, but there's
no, it's not the same story.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
But the the character of Anna in my novel and in my play is based on Fern, and
right.
Yeah, and we're inviting book clubs to get involved with this in Chicago, and actually we're setting one up online so that people elsewhere could get involved in this as well. Visions of Anna sort of sets the stage for it. You get to meet the character of Anna, and then it's a fictional version. It's not a biography in any way, but then to follow that up by reading a novel written by Fern, I think it really becomes interesting. And when we do the play, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was just going to say the novel, Fern's novel, was one that was previously unpublished. Is that true?
Yes, yes, she wrote it, and she wrote it in the 80s, and she commits suicide in 1988. So it was never published.
So this is giving her work a new audience too, and people to rediscover.
Yeah, her short work had been published, and she had won some awards, but she hadn't got to the point where she got the novel published.
So you were obviously shaken or affected by her death, her suicide. Did you know that she had suffered from depression for a long time? Was it a sudden thing for you to have heard about it? Or I mean, it's never expected, I guess, but if someone is struggling, you sometimes know it. It's a possibility.
Yeah. You know, she and I had talked years before about suicide. I knew it was a preoccupation of hers. But when it came, it was quite a surprise and a shock. And, you know, she and I had been in graduate school together, and before graduate school, we had concentrated on different art forms. And she had worked in music and me in theater. And it was in graduate school where we were studying fiction writing and developed that identity as novelists together. And we're very close friends. So when she was gone, yes, it left an empty space that no one else could quite fill.
Sure. And you obviously, this is a great tribute to her, as well as this idea of storytelling and people getting different points of view and different chances to have stories told in both the fiction form and also on stage. That's an exciting world premiere coming up in April. Comprise the trilogy. When you write, how do you decide? I mean, is it something that do you really decide, or does it just come to you, the idea of whether you're going to make it into a novel or a story or a play? I mean, is it something that you find the story and then you figure out the media to put it in, or you already have an idea that that's what you want to do?
You know, I find for me that the story decides what media it's going to be in. In fact, there were a number of times where I was writing fiction where I really wanted to be writing a play, where I, you know, wanted to take something to the theater, but the story wouldn't go there. The playwriting space is very specific. Everything you write has to happen on a stage, and some stories just don't want to go there. They demand all of the narrative that is in a short story or in a novel.
Really, I agree with you. I find that true. The story, the characters are the ones that drive you to tell it in the first place, and how to tell it sort of just comes organically.
Yeah.
You can try to push it. You know, it doesn't always work when you try to manipulate it. Right?
And then you don't always know which story is going to survive the, you know, the opening romance of it, where you think, oh, I'm going to work on this.
Right.
But sometimes it peters out before you before you really get going.
Some of those romances are not—they're like a bad first date. Some of them, or a good first date, but they don't go the next.
Right.
Just keep going. That's why I always say, you know, quiet space and listening to what's sneaking up on you. The characters or the stories that sneak up on you and come and grip you are the ones that probably are the ones that need to be told next. At least that's my experience. But as you said, sometimes even if they seem to be exciting at the beginning, they sometimes do fizzle out, unfortunately. But
that the really interesting stories will start invading my dreams, that I'll start dreaming about them. And I have had scenes and other things suggested in dreams that have made their ways into works.
Really? And how different are they? I mean, obviously, it's a seed, and then, of course, it transforms itself. Just like an idea in your head never comes out the way it's going to be when you finally write it down. My experience. Yeah,
I think the more open you can be to the subconscious, the better everything works out, whether it comes through something that happened in a dream or just being very open when you're in the process of writing the first draft. So that things can just come in and surprise you, I think makes the liveliest writing. Sometimes
I think if you're too you want to adhere too strictly to what you have in your head, that may thwart actually the creative process, I guess. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about your process. How do you do it? I mean, you're busy. You're obviously running a theater as well. Do you have a strict schedule that you sit down and write every day for 2, 3, 4 hours? Do you wait till the muse strikes you? I mean, what's your process like?
Well, I have, since I've been running the theater company, I've been writing a little bit less than I used to. There's more of my arts time that's arts administration time than before I started writing the theater. So I really do need to lock in some space, some time space. But I've always been a person who worked freelance, so I am able to find time. And in my office, that's where I do I do freelance writing for a living, and I do that in my home office. But when I'm doing a first draft of a play or a novel, I'll get away from that. You know, I'll go out to a cafe and mm-hmm. and use my laptop and turn the internet off and turn my phone off in order to make that private space to work on something new.
That's so interesting. A lot of us do that. You know, you go to public space to get private space, which is interesting.
Exactly.
And also just inspiration sometimes. You're locked in, you know, when people tell me they're blocked, I also work as a creativity coach and counselor with people. And, you know, I said, well, change your physical space. See if that changes mm-hmm. things. And you'll open yourself up and just take a walk, go somewhere, go to a cafe, because actually sometimes you'll hear snatches of conversation. And for me, I'm always having music on. I mean, I like a little stimulus in the background, too, so it's okay for me to have mm-hmm. those other voices. But something may help you. You know, may spark something to get you going, and sometimes that's what you need to sort of reignite it. The right story, too, helps, getting that right story, because I think a lot of times, as you said earlier, flashes of ideas, and I will jot down a bunch of stuff, and it's like, I know some of these things are not going to come to fruition, but you don't know which ones will, so jot them down when you have them, and then see, you know, which one will take flight, as they say. And putting it together, again, the time thing, because a lot of people who listen to our show are people who are artists or aspiring artists, and they're always curious about working artists and how they make their time work and how they get over the blocks. I mean, if you don't have a good idea at a time, or do you ever feel like you're in a slump? I mean, clearly, if you're a freelance writer, you have a schedule to keep. You know, you have to, or deadlines to meet. Whether you keep a schedule or not, you have to meet those deadlines. But how do you get over if you have like an artistic block or a slump where you feel like I'm not really producing enough or it's not coming out the way I want to? What have you developed tricks over time, or you just wait till it passes? What do you do? Or has it never happened to you? Maybe. I'll give you a door number 3.
I don't find it happens to me as much as it did earlier in life. I think that there's something about having written a lot that helps you be more fluid. But I do know. I mean, I would be a bad boy years ago, and if I was stuck, I might go to a tavern to write and have a pint of beer to break through the inhibition. But that's not a good practice to get into, obviously. But I would do it on the rare occasion. I think having a space where you're going to go to it and do it regularly, the mind makes an expectation that you'll work. Preparing yourself the night before so that the ideas will be there when you sit down really helps.
Well, so how do you do that? What's your night before preparation?
You know, it's just it's sort of like talking to yourself, really, there's a section in my book where I talk about there was a fellow I met in Paris named DePoco, Mabella DePoco, who was a fine poet and novelist, and he had a conversation with me in the cafes, he could see that I was uncomfortable and was asking me why. And I told him, you know, there was a novel I wanted to be working on and I wasn't intending to stay in Paris, and that that for that reason I was feeling uncomfortable. And he told me that I was uncomfortable because my voices were speaking to me and I wasn't listening. And he said, you know, there were times when he had something to work on, the voices were speaking to him, and he had nowhere to live. You know, he was homeless at the time, and he just sat down in an alley, and he wrote. And he said that that's our responsibility, and if we don't listen when the voices speak to us, we will be uncomfortable, and eventually they'll stop talking to us, and then we'll be the most useless thing of all, a writer without voices. And so I left the cafe. The cafe, and I was staying at the Shakespeare and Company bookstore in Paris at that point, living for free under George's roof.
Fabulous.
And went back and wrote 10 pages, borrowed George's typewriter and wrote 10 pages, which was very fast for me in those days. And, you know, then ended up staying in Paris for quite a long time and had a wonderful time and became pretty prolific during that period.
But what a great lesson that he gave you, because I think that's so true, because like you said earlier, the more you do it, the easier it is. So it's the same kind of thing, only it's more spiritual concept of, you know, they're going to keep talking to you up to a point, and they're going to say, well, I guess you're not really going to be the catalyst, are you? So we're moving on. I think that's a good point. You got to keep at it, and you got to keep listening, and you have to make time. We live in such a kinetic, sort of chaotic society where everybody's plugged in and you know, you're plugged in but you're really tuned out of your own voices and your own inner life sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
So you really do have to find the time to unplug and tune in to
and that,
what's going
and
on
that's
inside
that thing
your head.
With the subconscious of you know, it's the voices, it's being open to them, and that's that conversation I would have with myself the night before to open myself up to those voices and ask them to, you know, help me carry on the next day with whatever it was that I wanted to create.
Yeah, come play with me tomorrow. Although sometimes they wake you up at 3 a.m. and they want you to play.
That
sometimes happens, right?
Well, I would.
We're
keep
not
a,
waiting.
You know, I would keep a notebook by the bedside so that if I woke with one of those itty bitty book lights, so if I did wake up, sometimes you get something, and if you don't write it down, it's gone the next morning.
It's gone, exactly. It's very precious. It really is, and exciting. And a lot of people will say, oh, it's very romantic, and there is a romance to it, and there is an alchemy to it, but there's also a lot of work that comes after that. So, you know, those are little gifts, but you have to work those gifts and put in the time and the effort. But I thought when you said you get ready the night before that you lay out your clothes. Like, you ever hear that John Cheever used to dress in a suit and go down to the basement to write or whatever, because he thought that was taking it seriously? I don't know if you do anything like that. I mean, I certainly don't go to that extreme myself.
No, I don't feel it's necessary to wear a suit when I'm writing.
What about music? Do you have music on? Do you have complete silence? Obviously, you don't have complete silence when you go to a cafe, but...
No. Sometimes I have music, sometimes I don't. Usually there is in a cafe. And the other thing is, you know, I keep headphones in my little satchel in case the conversations that sometimes can be inspiring become too distracting.
Good idea.
I can plug in some headphones and tune them out and get to work.
Get down to business. Fascinating process. And I appreciate you sharing that with us, because I think a lot of people get inspired when they hear other people who they know are doing it and have done it successfully over time, and what they go through, and that it's not always a smooth ride. I think there's also a perception that it comes easily all the time. It may sometimes come easily, but you know, sometimes you got to work it, right, and you have to.
Yeah, it's I think a lot of people don't, when they think of writing, they think because they use language every day and speaking that they ought to be able to write, but it's like any. You know, it's like any art form, you really have to practice it. And I think writing about a 500,000 words is a huge step towards becoming
right.
becoming really good.
And reading,
becoming
reading
fluid.
Helps.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and reading helps too. What are some of your influences, your literary influences, and have they evolved over the years, or how have they evolved?
Well, you know, I think that the things that I was reading in graduate school and after, when I was really developing my voice, probably had more influence on me than what I'm reading now. Because, you know, that was when I was in more in the development phase. I still love reading now, but I don't feel as big of an influence on me personally, except for, you know, subject matter and things like that. Your fascinations always change. But I loved Kerouac, you know, for his rhythms, the great rhythmic flow of his work. I loved Fitzgerald and Hemingway and Dostoevsky and God, so many wonderful writers were influential on me. I think
and,
of
and different
F. Faulkner, the richness of, you know, there's such a range between people when you look at someone like Faulkner next to Hemingway, the simplicity next to the intensely rich work. And Lawrence Durrell, I love Lawrence Durrell, the Alexandria Quartet, amazing work.
You really have a big span of, you know, obviously you're well-read, which most writers are, but you're also influenced by a lot of different types of writing, which then gets
yeah.
filtered through whatever else you might have that just comes from your own life and your own experiences and who you are, and that's kind of fascinating too.
Yeah, and, you know,
how
we're writers now, where those people that were of their time. You end up, yeah, it's best to be of one's own time in the end.
Well, yes, I think that's a very good point. Well, it's true because I've had students who read things and they love. One student who just loved Somerset Maugham, and he tried to write like that. And I said, well, you know, you might want to try to read some more contemporary people too, and just see what comes.
Right.
You know, because you want to write in this time. And I think it's true. It's like how we develop our style. It's very interesting, and that's also very ethereal,
yeah.
because who knows? I mean, it is, you go through, I mean, I guess as you're developing, as you said, when you develop, you sort of do imitation at first, imitate
mm-hmm.
a story or a writer or whatever. But then you have to work on your own style, clearly.
Mm-hmm.
But what does that mean? You know, and there's no definitive answer for that. It comes out. And
mm-hmm.
And I write in different genres and different things, and there's always a certain thing about my style that comes through, whatever it is I try to write. So I think that's what it is. It just is there. And hopefully
mm-hmm.
it gets better and more honed over time, but it is yours. And I think that's
right.
And it's important to find and hone your own voice when you can.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about the play for a second here. Now that's going to debut
sure.
This spring. Where did the play came first? Is that right? Or the play came after?
The novel came first, and
okay.
then the play is still
okay.
developing. In fact, you know, just last night I was thinking of some things I wanted to change in it. So it, you know, with a play, it tends to keep changing almost
yes.
up to opening night.
Right. Yeah.
You keep developing it, and then, you know, even after the first production,
yes.
playwrights will often sit down and rewrite the script before sending it
yes.
out, hoping to get the second production and more.
Yeah, definitely, and it's a thrill because that's I've had the thrill of working with directors and actors and just the collaborative process, which is so
mm-hmm.
different than when you're sitting in a room by yourself writing
mm-hmm.
it and what they bring to it and how it evolves and as you hear it in rehearsal and beyond. I think you're
yeah.
right. That's so great. But just give us, because I don't know that for just people to have a little synopsis of what the setup of the novel and then the play and how it fits in with Fern's book as well, just so people have a sense of the story, because I don't think we did that.
Yeah, in the play, Matthew Harkin finds himself in the afterlife. The play is called Anna in the Afterlife. And he doesn't know where he is at first, and he begins meeting friends who have died. in this afterlife situation, including his friend Anna. And Anna has somehow split into three parts. You know, there's the Anna that he knew in life, and then there's this afterlife Anna who has continued to gather experience on the other side, as it were, and an Anna who is stuck very young by some childhood trauma. So she's in three pieces, and he comes to realize that he's in the afterlife because his body is on the operating table, and he seems to have some choice as to whether he will return to life or not. So, so he relives some scenes of his life and you know, his friendship with Anna and with his family, and he's faced with this decision as he goes through and reclaims memory and learns new things.
And in Visions of Anna, you also have a life and death thing going on too. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, in Visions of Anna, that character, you know, it starts with him knowing that he has a terminal case of prostate cancer, and he is driven to go to the place where his friend Anna has committed suicide to finally try and figure out what went on there. He has some kind of irrational hope that by understanding something about that, it will help him prepare for his own demise. So he goes and he meets Anna's friends who were with her at that time, and it finally leads him to a shaman who performs a ceremony both for him and for Anna that kind of unlocks a lot of what's going on with his health and with Anna's spirit in the afterlife. So it's a different story, but there's some things that have parallel where we get into their history a bit.
And what made you pick She Plays in Darkness, Fern's book, as a companion for that? Just tell people a little bit, you know, because
well, there's some, yeah, in that novel, you know, as well as it just being a really compelling story, there's a certain self-destructiveness in the main character that I thought paralleled the Anna character. And there are twins. The protagonist has an identical twin that seemed to parallel a little bit of this idea of the split that's in the play.
Right, yes.
The character splitting into different pieces. And there were a number of things that some of them that I don't want to give away because they're really interesting when you discover them in reading.
Yeah.
And I think would be less so if someone just told you.
Yeah, yeah. No, you don't want to get, you just want to give a little tease so people have a sense of what it's about,
right.
But you don't want to give the whole story away, of course. But it's a fascinating concept, the idea of putting these two novels together and also a play, because then again, you're playing with both story and media and how to tell it and telling the story, which I think is fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Congratulations. I know the books are just coming out next week, correct? Both Visions of Anna and
we're, on
Tuesday
night.
Available.
On Tuesday night, we're having the book launch at the Greenhouse Theater Center, which is our home space for Polarity Ensemble Theater. We're a resident theater there. But the books actually are available now on Amazon.com. And then we will be going. We'll be having events at a number of places around the Chicago area, and the books will be available at a few independent, wonderful independent bookstores in Chicago. One of them is the Bookseller in Lincoln Square in Chicago, and another one is City Lit Books in Logan Square area, and Bookends and Beginnings up in Evanston, Illinois. So those three at least will be. Oh, and then it'll be on sale at the, there's a little bookstore in the Greenhouse Theater Center, and they'll be available there as well. So we love people to support the, you know, the local independents, and of course our
home. I agree with that.
If
you can find an independent bookseller, please support them because they're dying out. But for folks who are not in the Chicago area, you can certainly get them online at Amazon. And so they're available
now,
right, on Amazon?
Right today you could go and get them.
Do you have a website that people can go to, or what's the best place to find out all the info on you?
Yeah, I think if people went to richardengling.com, there are links to the Afterlife Trilogy page, and that's probably the easiest thing to remember. And I should probably spell my last name. It's Richard Engling, and the Engling is ENGLING.com.
I'll post it also. I'll post the link so people can easily access it both on Twitter and Facebook. So if anybody misses it, it'll be right there. And a fascinating idea. The books are very intriguing, and the play sounds fascinating. And I think putting them all together is quite a brilliant idea, and one that's very refreshing. And I wish
I think one of the things that's going to be really fun was when we'll have events with the play, where people who have read the two books can come in and discuss the experience of all three with the cast of the play, and the Greenhouse is a wonderful place there. You can get cocktails and bring them into the theater. So after the show, we can all sit down and have a glass of wine and talk about the experience of reading both books and seeing the play. It'd be really fun.
Sounds like a fabulous idea. And if I'm in Chicago, I'll look you up. Okay.
Yeah.
Richard Engling, really a pleasure. Thank you so much. I wish you the best with your Afterlife Trilogy and all your other projects. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Take care. That's Richard Engling. Find out more at his website, richardengling.com. I will, again, as I said, post all the links to find out more about the Afterlife Trilogy. It does sound exciting. Plug in to us here at the Amy Beth Erkowitz Show, 347-857-4505, or on the Twitter feed at AB Writes. It is an early autumn Friday. Here's Lady Ella.
Another earth. laughter share another early autumn.
Autumn Serenade from Lady Ella on the Amy Beth Arkui Show. Thanks again going out to Richard Engling. I'm telling you, that Afterlife trilogy sounds fascinating. The books, Visions of Anna, and She Plays in Darkness, his late friend Fern Schurtko's novel, are captivating, and the play, Anna in the Afterlife, sounds intriguing. Find out more at his website, richardengling.com. As I mentioned, I will post the links a bit later with our podcast. And don't forget, if you missed the interview or any of the shows, you can always catch them on podcast. Follow the Amy Beth Arkui Show at the Blog Talk Radio site. Download episodes there at iTunes, NetNow, and, of course, at our website, amybetharkui.com. So we've been talking, I know, in social media, and we re-aired our viral show with Wendy Feldman, who has become the Giudice's crisis manager and, I guess, now official prison coach, as they're getting ready to do some time. But the vintage interview in which she said she would never work with them. We re-aired that yesterday and got some responses about the sentencing and all of the hoopla surrounding it, which is very intriguing. The sentence took forever. I mean, Judge Esther Salas, who eventually did the right thing, she took forever to get to it, very loquacious. But I guess it was also, it's interesting to us because we're so used to, those of us who are justice junkies, to plug into either a television cast or an online stream. Federal courts, you can't do that. They don't have any cameras in the courtroom. They don't see it in real time. In fact, the reporters, who did a pretty good job, there were a few people who were out there tweeting a lot, but they had to leave the courtroom to tweet because they weren't allowing live tweeting within the courtroom. So they had to strategically plan their breaks to get out there. So you talk about covering the story and doing it well. And, of course, a case like this also invited the reemergence of the courtroom sketch artists, who have been largely displaced by the cameras. So they got their due yesterday, too, in following the story. But they were doing it. I was following it from time to time during the busy day, and it just took forever. Joe was sentenced before lunch, I guess, about 11:30, 12, I don't know what time it was. But Teresa didn't get sentenced officially until about 4:45. Now, I guess they had some arguments going back and forth with the lawyers. Ultimately, the judge, which I think was pretty interesting, said that she sentenced them and thought about, she said, thought about going for leniency, but just couldn't do it. She said she had to make an example because sometimes celebrities do get perceived leniency. She said she couldn't go easy on Teresa Giudice because she needed to make an example out of her. And she said, quote, for a moment, I thought about probation. For a moment. And a lot of people were speculating that she would only get house arrest. And, of course, the prosecution vehemently was against house arrest because they put it this way, to give her house arrest in the house that bank fraud built would be an injustice, which is true. But she said that probation or home confinement was ultimately not an option. I need to send a message that it isn't who you are, how famous you are, or if you do something wrong, there will be consequences to pay, she said. And she also added that she thought about probation, but there was no way she could go lenient on her or them because they continued, get this, they continued to omit things and to lie and manipulate the system after the plea deal. They had to fill out forms of their assets and their finances, and they left a lot of things out. They tried to weave and dodge and blame a so-called an accountant, which apparently is an imaginary accountant because no one can find this person. They tried to blame the show. They tried to blame the death of Joe's father, who died tragically of a heart attack over the summer. It just didn't wash with the judge. So ultimately, Teresa got 15 months. Joe got 41 months. And, you know, I don't know. What do you think? Is it fair? Isn't it fair? You can weigh in. I know we talked about it online yesterday. Certainly weigh in on Twitter at AV Rights or via the studio line 347-857-4505. I would say it's fair because I really thought that she might have gotten probation or house arrest, which I think would have been an injustice. I thought maybe the judge would give her like 9 months and she'd do 6 months. In federal time, a lot of people are saying, oh, she's going to get out like Paris Hilton. It's not going to the county jail for a couple of days. They have a truth in sentencing law, which means you have to do about 85% of your sentence. So she got 15 months, she will probably do 13 months. That's what Piper Kerman did. If you read the book Orange is the New Black, or you saw the show that it's based on, she got a 15-month sentence and did 13 months. So that's what Teresa's facing. Now, the judge did cut them a break. They will have staggered sentences. She will go first, and then Joe will go. He's got a 41-month sentence and a possible deportation after that. I suspect he won't get that, but who knows. So that one parent will be home with the kids. And she's also allowing her to start serving her sentence on January 5th so that she can be with the kids through the holiday season. I think it's fair. I mean, they're not murderers. They did commit a string of financial crimes over a very long period of time. They got a sweetheart deal because they were charged with 41 counts, took a plea for four. And, you know, my feeling is people don't need to be in prison for life unless they are heinous criminals, unless they are people who are real threats to other people bodily, I think, or unless you commit a financial crime on the scale of Bernie Madoff, then you can be in jail for life. But a person, people like this, you know, I think some time is warranted. I think she did the right thing, but not forever. And they do have a family, and it is heartbreaking for the family. I know the people who are on their side are saying, you know, their heart breaks for the kids, and they have to think of their daughters, and she did try to play the child card. The truth is, though, 85% of women who are in prison are mothers, and many of those mothers don't have family to leave the kids with. So even without the staggered sentences, which was nice of the judge, they would have had grandparents, aunts, uncles. They have a big family, extended family, that could have taken care of these kids for a period of a year or so. It's still hard. Of course it's hard. And she loves her kids, regardless of the excesses, regardless of the bad parenting in terms of values and all of that. They love their kids. Nobody's questioning that. And nothing needs to be forever, so I agree. But it is kind of outrageous that after they took the plea deal, they still weren't dotting their I's and crossing their T's and saying, you know, this is it. We're caught now. Now we better do the right thing. They still haven't done it. I think there was a letter that Joe's mother sent to the courtroom because she apparently is in failing health as well. And she said, my son needs a slap on the wrist. He needs to come home to his family. And the judge says, you need to pay attention to the laws of our country. You need to understand them, and you need to follow them. And I don't even think you understand what you did. And that's the problem. They don't seem to understand what they did wrong. That's Teresa's war cry in the show, if you watch it, is, I don't know why this is happening to us. We're good people. Well, I'm not saying you're bad people, but you brought this on yourself. It's not the show. But Bravo, which, you know, they're pretty shady, too. They haven't made a comment yet, although I will say that this weekend, Teresa and Joe are sitting down for a taped interview with Andy Cohen. I think it's today, in fact, or tomorrow, today or tomorrow, which will air Monday night. And they're also taping this weekend the Real Housewife reunion. So she has gotten a lot of heap of pain, the sentencing, followed by the interview, followed by the reunion, which, by the way, I heard rumors that Joe was demanding, if he would appear on the reunion, an extra $30,000. I'm not sure if he's appearing and if he got it. But Bravo's pretty crass, too, because they're running today, if you've noticed, if you follow this at all, select episodes from the very first season of The Real Housewives. And I happened to turn it on early this morning, and they showed a scene where Teresa's filling up her new house their new mansion that they just built, and she is paying $120,000 in cash for furniture. Who carries $120,000 in cash? It's crazy. So a lot of this they brought on themselves, but I do feel bad. Of course you feel bad for the kids. You can't not feel bad for the kids, and I feel bad for them too, because they're going to suffer now, and now they're going to pay the consequences, and sometimes you have to do it. That's just the way it goes. Your take, be happy to field it at AB Rights or on the phone line 347-857-4505. Twitter feed, of course, as we said, has been buzzing since yesterday about it. Most people think it's good they went to jail. One person says they should have gotten more time. They got off easy, says Carly. Well, you know, again, I don't know. I'm not for putting people in jail forever, Carly. I'm just not, unless they're, killers. That's a different story. And Ross says, can they film it in jail? No, they can't. Federal prison, certainly not. You will not film it in jail. So she's going to be off the screen for a while. And that's also going to be harder for her even in the confinement, probably. I know there are people, here we go, here's one. Maxwell Smart says, she's going to a country club. Well, we don't know officially where she's going, but she will be going to one of those prison camps. It'll either be Danbury, if it hasn't been converted back to a male prison, or most likely Camp Cupcake in Alderson, West Virginia, where Martha did her time. But you know what? Even if it's a quote-unquote Camp Cupcake, it's still going to be even if it's a so-called Camp Cupcake, it's still going to be confinement. It's still going to be away from her family. It's still going to be a lot more restricted, a lot less comfy and cozy than she's used to, a lot less palatial. So, I mean, it's still going to be confinement. I don't know. I've never gone to one of those places. I certainly don't want to go to one of those places. So I don't think you can say it's going to be great. She's not going to break rocks in the hot sun. She's not going to be in a dungeon, but it's still prison, and it's not going to be a fun experience for her, that's for sure. And by the way, you know, I think, and this is just me, perhaps, but I think actually the fact that she's going to be in prison and comes out of prison will give her a better chance in the public eye to regain any kind of celebrity status that she may have had. And you know why? Hear me out on this. Because I think there was so much anger fueling this case and the fact that she was going to get away with something. And if she got only house arrest in that mansion that she can't afford and was gotten by ill-gotten gains, that wouldn't be much. But if she can go away and is perceived as paying a price and come out, she's more likely to be afforded a clean slate in the public eye. I think that's the case, because I think whether she learns her lesson or not, we don't know. But she will definitely, be afforded more of a clean slate. Now, that doesn't mean there's going to be openings on reality TV for her anymore. These stars tend to fade. Kate Gosling keeps trying, but the fame fumes, they're still there, and she'll try to suck them up. I'm sure she'll try to sell stories to In Touch Weekly and these other places that she, Life and Style, whatever, where she has her connections. But it won't be the same. And I don't think they're doing themselves any favors, by the way, when they show on the television show her going house shopping from her deluxe hotel mansion to a slightly smaller mansion. They have small houses in New Jersey. They also have condos in New Jersey and apartments. There was one episode some seasons back where they ran a pizza parlor, and when times were tough and Joe was trying to tell her that times were tough and she wasn't hearing it, he said, "We're going to live upstairs in the apartment." There are people who do live in those kinds of places. And that may be a start to get your life back on track, because they also threw out their bankruptcy dissolution, I think, so they now have to pay back that $13 million, plus they got fines. So it's a long haul for them, so they have some hurt coming. So I don't know that they got off easy. I will say they have some hurt coming. They brought it on themselves. They deserve it, but, you know, let's be fair. They're not mass murderers. We'll see what happens. Speaking of a murderer, though, Jodi Arias back in the news. The convicted killer's glasses were sold at auction. I believe it went for $900-something bucks, and the food bank, though, is supposed to benefit St. Mary's Food Bank. And they're not happy about it. I say take the money. They got $980. We got an online donation from a gentleman that lives out of state. It was the amount of $980, so says Beverly DeMore, the president and CEO of the St. Mary's Food Bank Alliance in Phoenix, Arizona. It could have been made anonymously, but a thank you letter from St. Mary's for that donation is posted on the Jodi Arias website. The website claims the money was raised by auctioning off the eyeglasses that Arias wore during her murder trial. Remember, there was that story she was going to do it, but nobody knew what charity was going to get? But now DeMore says, well, we have no choice at this point but to treat it like we would any other donation. So, yeah. I think that's okay. But, of course, this has been a big distraction to her, but they didn't ask for it. They didn't solicit it. But somebody donated the money. Hey, it's for a good cause. Take the money, Beverly, and don't look back. That's what I would say. There's a big market. You know about this, right? There's a big market for this so-called murderabilia, where people buy things like from Charles Manson and John Wayne Gacy, his weird little clown pictures, and Jodi Arias. She's been selling her paintings, quote-unquote, you know, paint-by-number paintings. So people are into it, and if it goes to a good cause, why not? I think there's something wrong with that. By the way, she's having an awful hard time finding a quote-unquote impartial jury for her penalty phase, her second penalty phase. This I blame, again, I've said this before, the onus here is on the state of Arizona, because they have a really screwed-up law that says if the jury is deadlocked in the penalty phase, the state has a second bite of the apple to go for the death penalty. Look, I'm not a death penalty advocate. I don't like the death penalty no matter what, so I think she deserves life in prison. Anyhow, but if you do have the death penalty and they voted for it, that would be fine. But if they don't, most states that have the death penalty goes to the judge, and it's, I believe, automatically life in prison. Judge decides with or without parole. Some states, maybe the judge has the right to impose death. I don't know if it's deadlocked, but it goes to the judge. We don't have the second trial. How much money the state? If you're in Arizona and you're a taxpayer, I would be kicking up my heels over this. They have already spent over $2 million on this woman's defense, and now here we go again for phase two, and I'm sure she's going to drag it out. It's nuts. But she's booted the cameras out of the courtroom, so they have to wait till after the trial is over, if it ever gets underway, to actually see it on TV, as if people care. A lot of people still do. People are always talking about it and seething about it and writing about it and asking me about it. I know as much as you guys know, and all I can say is she's going down. Her life is over as it is whether she gets a death penalty or life, it's going to be life in prison, and it's going to be an unpleasant life in prison, I think. And she deserves it. That's the person who deserves to be sort of so-called kicked off the island, if you know what I mean, because she really did commit such a hideous offense, for sure. Hey, get involved in the show, 347-857-4505. Twitter feed's still available, too, at AD Writes, as we sashay back amongst the autumn leaves. Here's another classic, Natalie Cole's interpretation. I'm Amy Bedarkovich.
The falling leaves drift by the window, the autumn leaves of red and gold. I see your lips, the summer kisses, the sunburned hands I used to hold. Since you went away, the days grow long, and soon I'll hear old winter songs. But I miss you most of all, my darling, when autumn leaves 24/7 will stay out and will live forever now.
Two songs, same title, very different songs. Ed Sheeran's Autumn Leaves and Natalie Cole's We're Going to Way Around the Standard, Autumn Leaves for Harlow on this Fall Friday on the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show. Romping around the autumn leaves, one thing. Hit the water in autumn, you better bring a sweater. Here's a beauty from Dan Fogelberg. It's called The Reach.
As the coastline recedes, was a bayman like my father was before. Can't make a living as a bayman anymore. There ain't much future for a man who works the sea, but there ain't no island left for islanders like me. Yeah, yeah.
Billy Joel's Down Easter Alexa, and another beauty from Dan Fogelberg, The Reach, on the Amy Beth Arkwi Show as we take a musical romp through the autumn leaves. How are you? Thanks for joining us on our Friday show. We made it a pretty busy week indeed. Want to send out our Inspiration to Action shout-out today to one of our heartier regulars, Nixie, checking in. She tells us, you know, I've started with the challenge, been doing it, and journaling like mad for months. Now I think I actually can write a book. So I'm going to try it, and I'll keep you updated. Thanks so much. I guess I've been listening for more than just my pleasure. Well, thank you, Nixie. I hope it's both pleasure and productiveness. Keep us updated. Hey, if the Inspiration to Action Challenge has worked for you, by all means, let us know. I'd love to give you a well-deserved shout-out. It also helps spur other folks on. Reach out to the website, amybetharkwi.com. That's also the place to go if you need a little cajoling in the creative department. We have creativity coaching and counseling questions always answered. First conversation, always on me. And you can also find out more about the Eliza Gordon mystery series, My Stories, both Killing Time and Dead Silent, available for ebook and paperback. So check it out, won't you? And don't forget to friend us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at AB Writes, and, of course, follow the Amy Beth Arkwi Show at the Blog Talk Radio site, where you can always download episodes. All of them are archived for podcast. And yesterday we reran one of our viral episodes, the interview with Wendy Feldman, the crisis counselor slash prison coach who... before she teamed up with the Giudicis, and now she's helping them, I guess, prepare for prison, which is no fun story indeed. And people are being kind of cruel online. I think it's enough already. I believe they deserve some prison time, but I think they got it. So lay off. I mean, now they're talking about divorce and money they're going to own and money they're going to rake in and all this kind of stuff. Let it alone for a few minutes, because Bravo is certainly doing their darndest to capitalize on it, as they do, because... they're crass ratings grabbers. What else do reality TV mongers do? And we all who get involved in these shows or have over the years, and I cop to it as a guilty pleasure, fall for it sometimes or get sucked in. So sometimes step away. Step away from the TV. Step right into your podcast and have some fun. All right, I have a little unfinished business I have to take care of for Trudy, my producer, because the other day we had on... yeah, I'm going to do it, Trudy. I promise. She's been nagging me since I was remiss. We had on Heather and Andrea, the gals behind Barbara Jean Coast and the Poppy Cove Mystery Series, and we got so immersed in our fabulous 50s jukebox selections that I forgot the deal I have with Trudy. Every time a murder mystery author comes on, we have to roll out the Jerry Lewis classic. So here it is. I love a murder mystery upon the radio. I do.
Isn't that beautiful? I love a murder mystery upon the radio. I love it. I really love it, though. The heroine is yelling while the sponsor goes on selling.
Don't touch me, you brute!
Use delirium for your tube.
Sam shovels in the hovel, he must grovel for a clue. I love it, I rally do.
Sherlock Helms, the giver's arms, interrupted by the sponsor.
You see Watson, when the villain.
Painless Joe, do you thrill? I'm nervous when I turn the dial, I'm dizzy in the head. When it's time for Inner Sanctum, I go underneath my bed.
Don't shoot me, Biggs the Stoolie, as they put him through the mill.
I'll shoot you, seriously, I will. The girl he tried to take, and then we have a station break.
Come on, baby, come to me. Boing, boing, boing. This is Station COD.
He's not breathing. But how can he? He's dead.
Why, this is a job for Superman, or Hopalong Cavity, or Jack Headstrong, the All-American Boy, or Jerry Lewis. But I don't scare easily, not me. I'm too frightened to be scared. I'll find the killer. I'll search the apartment. Aha! Just as I thought. Three shoes under the bed. Well, that's logical for a man with 3 feet. But I have it now, Inspector. I can name your killer for you. His name is...
Stainless Joe will do you, darling. My flesh begins to creep, and then my skin begins to crawl. You think I was a worm the way I wiggled down the hall.
I love a murder mystery upon the radio. I love it. I love it. I really love it so. I love it when I'm listening late at night, and a murderer is stalking a heroine, and a hero is stalking a murderer, and a private eye is stalking a hero, and a cop is stalking a private eye, and they're coming in closer and closer, surely, but closer and surely. They're coming out of the radio. Now they're stalking me. What have I done? I was only listening to the radio. Now they're throwing toothpaste at me. They're coming closer and closer. And I don't know the conjunctive moves of anyone that may be based on the fact that other people say the same their facts. Where else but the splendor? And certainly not the one in the field. I'm not going on the moment. Anyone else may say I'm wrong. And I feel that I must stay here now. No one else will ever know the facts.
I wish I was dead.
Swingin' Radio England, where the music is new.
It's a marvelous night for a moon dance, with the stars up above in your eyes. A fantabulous night to make romance beneath the cover of October skies. Yet all the leaves on the trees are falling to the sound of the breezes that blow. Yet I'm trying to please to the calling of your heartstrings that play soft and low. Yet all the night's magic seem to whisper and hush. Yet all the soft moonlight seems to shine. Yet your blush. Can I just have one more moon dance with you, my love? Can I just make some more romance with you, my love? Well, I wanna make love to you tonight. I can't wait till the morning has come. Yet I know now the time is just right, and straight into my arms you will run. And when you come, my heart will be waiting to make sure that you're never alone. There and then all my dreams will come true, dear. There and then I will make you my own. And every time you just travel inside, then I know how much you want me that you can't hide. Can I just have one more moon dance with you, my love? Can I just make some more romance with you, my love?
Moon Dance Under the October Skies with Van Morrison on the Amy Beth Arkley Show, Sweet Seasons from Carole King, and a payback for Trudy, I Love a Murder Mystery, upon the radio as we celebrate the autumn. Fabulous fall season. Thanks so much for being with us. Hey, coming up on Tuesday, this is a fascinating story. Chris Tomlinson joins us. He is the former AP war correspondent and current Houston Chronicle staffer who has written this epic family history called Tomlinson Hill. He is descended from Texas slave owners, and he traces two branches of the Tomlinson family, the white branch and the black family of Tomlinsons that kept the name after emancipation, and really uncovers Texas history, American history, and a legacy of slavery and racism and race relations and family heritage. Very intriguing. I think there's a companion film, too, which I have to check out. So we will talk with him on Tuesday. Hey, by the way, if you'd like to be a guest on the show, we are always looking for compelling storytellers, from authors to filmmakers, musicians to theater folks, justice and personal growth experts. You know we love you, and social commentators, too. Go to the website, amybetharkawi.com. Trudy's got the big book. It's filling up already for November, believe it or not. But we have slots. You never know. We'll get you in. And December, of course, and next year. So if you have an upcoming project that you'd like to promote, get involved, and we'll see about getting you on the Media Bites award-winning podcast that has been dubbed Empowering Entertaining Tour de Force, and we can connect you with an engaged, literate, artistically-minded audience. That's what we do. That's who we have, and we love you all for being with us. So get involved, and we'll get you on the show. Simple as that. Miss a show? Check out the podcasts, all archived at the Blog Talk Radio site or at my website, amybetharkawi.com. Friend me on Facebook, and of course, it's a 24/7 Twitter conversation at AB Writes. Thanks again going out to Richard Engling. I'll post more information about the Afterlife Trilogy on both Twitter and Facebook throughout the weekend. And I hope you drive safe, play nice, dream big. Thank you, Trudy, Aurora, ML at TCS headquarters. I'm going to be spending my autumn weekend in New York, like most weekends. Here's Sarah Vaughn. Take care. Have a great weekend.
Autumn in New York. Why does it seem so inviting? Spells the thrill of best nighting. Glittering crowds and shimmering clouds in canyons of steel. They're making me feel I'm home. That brings the promise of new love. Autumn in New York, it's often mingled with pain. Dreamers with empty hands may for exotic land. It's autumn in New York. It's good to live it
to the Reality Channel.
Hate New York City. It's cold and it's damp. It leave Chicago to the Eskimo. That town's a little bit too rugged. You and me, you bad girl. Rolling down Imperial Highway, the big nasty red out of my side. That ain't a wind blowing hot from the north. On the ride, roll down the window, put down the top, crank up the beat for us, baby. Don't let the music stop. We gonna ride it till we just can't ride it no more. From the side, baby, to the valley, from the west side to the east side, everybody. Like I'm not.